yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now.
Centers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. The show is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to turn our attention back to the economy. Interesting developments in that area of the past week, and we're going to discuss them, put them in context here. Specifically, we're going to talk about first the jobs report of last Friday, a terrible jobs report, which I had predicted 3 months ago, but we'll discuss that in detail. We're also going to talk about the congressional budget deal, not the one that was temporarily stopgap measure signed in December, but the one that has just been passed by Congress here that will take us through the rest of the year until the new budget for 2015 becomes an issue in October of this year. You see, the budgets go from October to through September. Okay, so what's this addendum to the budget deal that got so much attention back in December? And this one, of course, hardly gets any attention. $1 trillion agreed to, compared to $63 billion that got all the attention back there in December. All right, and then we're going to talk, thirdly, about the Federal Reserve. We want to talk about Ben Bernanke, Bernanke's bank, the Federal Reserve. Bernanke is leaving here at the end of this month, and his replacement will be Janet Yellen, his former vice chair of the Fed, who will take over. And as I said many times, nothing really is going to change. The Fed is going to keep on feeding the banking beast and keeping that stock market from collapsing. Okay, so three topics here, economic topics, all in the news recently, the jobs report, the new budget, and Ben Bernanke's Fed. Okay, let's jump right into it. Jobs. Okay, if you've been reading the jobs report for December, caught a lot of folks by surprise. It was really poor. And if you dig down into the jobs report and the labor market in the U.S., you'll see really how poor the situation still is. And this follows, you know, some really hyped up prognostications about where the jobs markets were going in October and November, when they had officially, statistically, 200,000 jobs created. You know, you need about 150 at least to absorb new people coming into the labor market. You know, population is growing, so forth. People become job age and graduate from high school and colleges and go into the labor market. Every month we get, you know, 150,000, some say as low as 100,000 new entrants every month. So, you know, the labor force grows. Or does it? We'll see. Okay. So they reported 200,000 jobs in October, and I had written a piece called False Positives, an analysis of October jobs and the third quarter GDP report in the U.S. You can read that on my blog, jackrasmus.com. You can also read it on other blogs like Counterpunch and ZNet and so forth. So it's I'm on the record there. Go back and to November 12th. Where I commented on the jobs report, this big surge of 200,000 jobs in October that I said would disappear by December. Ooh, voila. September jobs were only 74,000 net new jobs created. 74,000. That's not even enough to absorb people coming into the labor force. And it is an abrupt turnaround from the trend that everyone said was now occurring back in October. Okay, so what's going on here? The jobs actually did disappear. or job creation, I should say, you know, down very low, 74,000. We'll see. That's not as bad as it really was. That's the statistic. I'll talk about that shortly. The actual raw data was much worse. Okay. All right, so I had predicted in October that the October job surge was a temporary effect. It was the consequence of last summer's exceptional growth in business inventory investment. You know, that's where businesses stock up on stuff. And, by the way, that stocking up accounted for over half, probably, of GDP growth in the third quarter last summer, which was pretty good, an aberration from previous trends, which I predict will fall back again. Okay, so big jobs in October were the result, I predicted, of a lag of this ramping up, bulking up of business inventories over late last summer, and businesses hiring in anticipation of consumer spending, retail sales, following up the big inventory buildup. In other words, businesses expected they'd be selling this huge stocking that they were stocking up, that they were building last summer. Ah, but has that happened? Well, but we got hiring and to make the stuff and hiring in anticipation of selling the stuff. And that's responsible for the bulk of GDP growth and the hiring in October. But I predicted this could very well disappear by December if the retail sales did not follow through. And as we will see, now we have a picture of declining retail sales numbers throughout the fall and in the last holidays as well. The last holiday period here. Retail sales rose 0.5% 0.5% in October. That declined to 0.4 in November and declined last month to 0.2. So we have a declining trend going on in retail sales. And that's what forced retailers to engage in big discounts here during the recent holiday season sales to get people to buy the stuff because people just weren't buying. So they moved the stuff out, but in many cases at a loss. As we will see, retailers' profits are going to take a big hit, and these discounts are going to disappear and already are here in the first quarter. Most ominous behind the retail sales slowdown was a big drop in auto sales. Now, auto sales are the big element within retail sales, account for much of it, most of it, almost, and the auto sales have been holding up a poor consumer spending picture over the past year. People have been buying autos. Why? Because autos engaging in big discounts. Yeah, you can buy last year a new car with nothing down and nothing the first month and 000 is the marketing message, right? Nothing down, nothing the first month, right? Zero interest, and that was a free loan and so forth. Well, you know, consumers picked up autos last year, but this is all of a sudden coming to a halt as people, you know, have bought, a lot of them have bought cars in the last 2 years, and the demand is being saturated here. Okay. The retail sales picture is not that positive for the holidays, especially ominous to auto sales. Now, we get a non-auto sales surge, but that was because of the discounting. Businesses anticipate that discounting can't go on forever, and therefore we started to get a decline in hiring in December. Now, mainstream economists will say, oh, it's the weather. The weather is the result of the slowdown in retail sales, and therefore the job, slow job tick up in December of only 74,000 jobs. But wait a minute. You know, people went out and bought food and gas and clothing. It didn't seem to cause a problem there. It just caused a problem in certain other goods and services. No, weather metaphors don't explain anything. They're an excuse for people who have no explanation. Or they say, oh, it's a technical glitch. You know, you read the papers. Oh, there was a technical glitch. Well, what is the glitch? I can't find it explained anywhere in the press as the cause of the low job creation. Thirdly, that it was a correction to the overestimation of jobs created in October and November. Well, if so, you know, if we're getting these wide swings in job reporting by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, maybe there's something wrong with the Bureau of Labor Statistics approach and methodologies. Okay, the U.S. labor market in 2013 was a disaster. And that's 5 years after the so-called recovery that started in 2009. We see 74,000 jobs created in December, way below the average, way below what's necessary to absorb new people coming in the labor market. But even more importantly, we see that 347,000 workers left the labor force, gave up finding jobs. That's even more significant. And that 347,000 drop in people leaving the labor force in 1 month follows a 700,000 drop in leaving the labor force in October. Okay, now some of those because of the government shutdown, but you know, let's take half off of that. So we still got 700,000 people leaving the labor force in the fourth quarter of last year. Now, people don't leave the labor force when the labor market is healthy. In fact, they enter. But we got a mass exodus of people leaving the labor force. It means they can't find jobs. So they're giving up on it. Could be as high as 1 million in the last 3 months. More people are leaving the labor force than people are getting new jobs. And those who are even getting jobs are getting low-paid service jobs. If you look at the first half of last year, 2013, almost two-thirds of all the jobs created were what we call contingent jobs. In other words, voluntary part-time jobs, temp jobs, and so forth. Now, the government reports part-time jobs, involuntary and voluntary part-time jobs, but it doesn't accurately import the temp jobs. There is a statistic called a temporary agency hiring, but businesses don't always go through a temp agency to hire temps. You know, they do it directly themselves. So the numbers have been underestimated for temporary work and temporary employment. The government used to keep some records on that in the 1990s, but when George W. Bush came in office, he cut back on that. So we don't really have a good picture of temporary job creation. But we do know, if we look at the official temps, a significant number of temp jobs being created, and, of course, involuntary part-time jobs, especially in the first half of last year. Now, that sort of moderated in the second half, but, you know, when you create most of the jobs and they're low-paid jobs, then median family income tends to fall, which, of course, it has been. The wealthy folks make purchases mostly based on what's called the wealth effect. In other words, if their stock and bond values are going up, then they feel wealthier, then they'll spend more. And, you know, the wealthiest 5-10%, they've been spending like banshees, doing very well. But the rest of us, with low wage creation at the median as well as below, we're limited to buying not on our income rising because our wages aren't, but buying based on credit extension and discounts and so forth. And that's what most of the rest have been purchasing based upon. Okay. So we have this picture of low-wage creation to the extent we even have job creation. And the picture of contingent jobs, part-time temp jobs, which pay about 50 to 60, 70% maybe of a full-time job, that's going on this year, and actually it's been going on for about 4 or 5 years now. It's nothing new. All right. But more importantly, we have all these people dropping out of the labor force altogether. So low-wage, low-pay service job creation to the extent we're creating jobs, and massive departure in the second half of the year of people leaving the labor force, and a temporary surge in jobs based upon a temporary one-time development and excessive inventory accumulation in the third quarter. Not long-term trend data here, right? Now, the 74,000 jobs way below par created is not the actual number of jobs created. That's what we call a statistic. What's a statistic? It's a manipulation of raw actual numbers. In other words, you get the raw data and you smooth it out. And in fact, most statistical methods by the government are designed to smooth out the swings in the data. Smooth out the price inflation swings, smooth out the GDP, and smooth out jobs and unemployment. And they've been getting very clever about smoothing over the last three decades since Reagan. For example, let's take prices, right? You got the consumer price index now barely growing at 1%. It's been declining, actually, for the last several years. You know, you don't get declining prices when you got a robust recovery. It's an indication that the recovery is not really very strong, so prices sag for goods and services. Of course, the demand for financial securities, stocks and bonds and so forth, is very high because that's where all the money is going, to the wealthy folks. And then we see the stock market surge and bond market surges. Okay, so that's where the wealth is going, to the wealthy, and they're buying stocks and financial securities and driving inflation there, but it's not going to the rest of us. So real goods and services prices are falling or declining in their rate of increase. And why? Well, they smooth out the actual price effects. Inflation is really probably more than 1%, but it comes in at 1% or less because of smoothing techniques, right? The government uses chained indexes. It changes its weighting. It offsets actual price increases by assumptions of quality improvements and so forth. So, you know, we don't get as big a swing up in prices, and we don't get as big a swing down in prices. That is the reality. And then there's business investment. This summer, the government, because business investment contribution to GDP is declining, what did the government do? They redefined what is business investment. They said that expenses on research and development and business expenses are now investment. Pricing of intellectual property and intangibles, you know, that's a pretty shaky thing to do anyway. How do you price intellectual property and intangibles? But anyway, they come up with their methodologies, and they boost business investment by $552 billion in 2012, more than actually occurred. And that's playing a role in boosting GDP in the second half of this year as well. Okay, and we got this smoothing out that occurs with jobs and unemployment. Okay, so statistically, smoothing the raw data, last December we get only 74,000 jobs created and 347,000 people leave the labor force. But the actual raw data regarding jobs is a decline in December of 246,000 jobs and a fall in the labor force of 502,000. Much worse than the statistical smoothing. Oh, but you know what? The fact that you have so many people leaving the labor force, that reduces the unemployment rate because of the way the government calculates unemployment rates. Unemployment is, you know, number of people defined, divided by the number of people in the labor force. So if the labor force declines, the unemployment rate declines. It's not that jobs are being created. It's that people are leaving the labor force, therefore the unemployment rate goes down. You can have a decrease in jobs, right? I mean, you know, an actual decrease in jobs, and the unemployment rate may fall because the labor force is declining. Okay. That's a little tour through how these numbers are created. All right, so unemployment rates, forget them. They're irrelevant. You know, there's the U3 unemployment rate, the one you get reported in the press, the most conservative. That's the one that now just dipped below 7%, okay? And then there's the U6 unemployment rate, where there's a little bit of attempt to make an adjustment for sharp increases in underemployed, part-time employed, and so forth. The U6 unemployment rate still has 20 million people jobless in the U.S., right? But it's still grossly underestimates the number of people leaving the labor force. Now, there are two other statistics that the economists use that are more interesting and more reflective of what's really going on long-term in the labor movement, and that's called the labor force participation rate. That was a percent of the population that's in the labor force. That's been declining dramatically. And a second indicator called the employment to population ratio. Now, in other words, as population is growing, are we creating jobs to keep up with population growth? And those two indicators have been in a steep decline, especially since 2008. Okay, here's an interesting piece of data here, right? What I call indication of the great jobs churn that's going on long-term in the U.S. But before I get into the numbers, let's just take another break, our first break here, and we'll come back and, you know, go get your pencil out, and I'm going to give you some interesting numbers here on what's happening with the labor force and the participation rate and the EPOP. Okay, Jack Rasmus, this is Alternative Visions. We'll come back talking about the jobs report. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, and we're talking about three topics on the recent economy here. One is the jobs report, and we're sort of dissecting that and going deeper into it of last Friday, and then we'll talk about the recent budget deal, addendum to the budget deal of December, and then I want to talk about Bernanke's bank. Okay, back to the jobs picture. Okay, I promised you some numbers before the break here. Again, the problem in the labor market today is not just this stop-go, low job creation number. And we see stop-go. Okay, we had a little go here in October, November. Now we got another stop. This has been going on stop-go for 4.5 years now. Okay, the job market just can't heal, it seems. And the jobs that are being created are low-paid service jobs. And the jobs we are losing are higher-paid. And as new people come in to the labor force, 100,000 plus a month, you know, we have about the same number who are leaving. We got a big jobs churn going on several dimensions. You know, low pay versus high pay leaving, low pay coming in, service jobs coming in, full time leaving, part time coming in, that kind of a ebb and flow. And as many people leaving the labor force as people coming in. If you look at the civilian labor force, that is everybody except in the military and institutionalized folks, you know, in prisons and so forth, and children 16 under. If you look at that civilian labor force, in June 2009, we had 154,900,000 people in the civilian labor force. Last month, December 2013, we had 154,400,000. Okay, it hasn't changed. In fact, it dropped 500,000 in almost 5 years. Well, wait a minute. You know, you got to add the fact that there's 100,000 plus or more. Let's take the low end estimate, 100,000 coming in, new entrants into the labor force every month. You know, over 4.5 years, 100,000 a month, that's over 5 million people entering the labor force. So the labor force should have risen by 5 million, but it is roughly the same number of 5 years ago, in fact, 500,000 less. So that means that 5 million must have left the labor force. For the numbers to stay pretty much constant, when you got 100,000 a month coming in, as I said, that's a low end. Some estimate 150,000 new entrants a month. But let's take the conservative number. So 5 million new entrants and 5 million dropouts. 5 million dropouts. Well, that's why the labor force participation rate is falling. And EPOP is declining. The ratio, employment to population ratio, has been progressively declining. Okay, we created about 5 million jobs. If you look at total employed non-farm, 2009, 139 million people in non-farm employment. I was not counting the unemployed. And 144 million in 2013. So about a 5 million jobs created since 2009, the end of the recession in June 2009, official end. Okay, 5 million created, but the labor force hasn't changed. Even though 100,000 a month are coming in, it's about the same size. So you could deduce from this that what we've got is 5 million jobs, low-pay jobs, as the numbers indicate. Other studies, for example, have showed that 60% of the jobs we've lost since the end of the recession, 60% of the jobs we lost were high-paid. In other words, paid more than $18 an hour. Not that that's so high, but that's, you know, the cutoff. Whereas we've hired 58% of all the new hires are low-paid, below $13 an hour. So we got a churn, high-paid leaving and low-paid coming in. We've got a churn of new entrants coming in and people dropping out of the labor force. And by the way, we also have a churn of non-union hires and union jobs disappearing in 2012. 500,000 union jobs disappeared while the economy hired over a million people. Okay, so a great churn going on in the labor market. I think this churn has something to do with problems that the Bureau of Labor Statistics has with accurate estimations. All right, we talked about that. So great churn one, 5 million entering, 5 million leaving. Churn two, entering at low pay, leaving at higher pay. Churn three, union jobs lost, non-union jobs coming in. All right. A final note regarding jobs. Final note here. It's not the weather. It's not technical glitch. Right. The jobs decline in December has to do with the inventory surge and expectations of consumer spending retail in the holiday season that did not turn out. So hiring slowed, right? And now we're going to see layoffs coming here in the first quarter, as we always do, following the holiday season. I think auto sales are going to continue to weaken. And non-auto retail sales are also going to weaken as retailers drop their deep discounts that are leading to profit problems. Right? And then other consumer spending like housing we're seeing slowing down as well as mortgage rates rise. Although foreigners are buying and institutions are buying up housing stock and builders are building housing stock in anticipation of foreign demand for it. And wealthy demand for it. You know, top 10% households, they're doing great. But watch out for a new statistical adjustment here in the jobs number, the reported statistical jobs numbers in the first quarter. of this year, because the government's going to revise its benchmarks. I won't go into detail what that is, but it will mean adding another 200,000 plus jobs in the first quarter. So the actual jobs number, the raw data on jobs, will decline, perhaps, but the statistical reports will not show as much of a slowdown. The gap between statistical and actual jobs will probably widen. And one final note, as this all happens, what we're going to see is unemployment insurance being cut. That was recently decided here last week. You know, the Senate even voted to reduce extended unemployment benefits for 1.3 million people, and that's right now immediately at the end of the 2013, and there'll be at least that many more who are long-term unemployed and exhausting their unemployment benefits. So 3 million people are going to lose their unemployment benefits. It didn't have a chance of passing the U.S. House anyway, but still, even the Senate, right? What's the impact on consumer spending and retail? 3 million people without anything can be interesting. Or on the unemployment rate, or on the labor force dropouts. Well, we'll see. Right, but there is a relationship there. Not a pretty picture as far as jobs are concerned. All right, since we talked about the unemployment insurance issue, let's segue nicely here into the latest government budget deal. Right, government budget. I had written on my blog in December, and even before that, predicting there would be a budget deal between the radical, quote, Republican House and its Tea Party faction after the fiasco of the budget government shutdown in October and the debt ceiling deal, both sides, both wings of the single-party system, Republicans and Democrats, and the Republicans with their Tea Party faction, have had a fill of brinksmanship for a while. You know, they never do this in an election year. They always sort of downtone their confrontations in election year. They did that in 2012, and then they stepped it up, the fight, in 2013. Well, 2014 is a congressional midterm election, so they're both going to behave themselves and go slow on austerity here. But they'll pick that up again after the midterm elections coming up this November. But I had predicted that last October as well that there would be a budget deal, and there was. It was a very minor deal, right? Only worth $63 billion. All that hullabaloo over $63 billion last December, and they came to agreement, right? Ryan, the darling of the Tea Party in the House, and Murray, a liberal, Democrat liberal in the Senate, they came together and they agreed to restore, as they said, $63 billion of the $1.2 trillion in sequestered cuts that were going to start to take effect. Okay, so it was a minor two-year partial agreement last December of restoring $63 billion in sequestered cuts, about half of which were social program cuts and half of which were defense cuts. $31 billion. They yelled, hurrah, we restored $31 billion in social spending cuts. Oh, but at the same time, they pay for it by taking $25 billion out of unemployment extension and another $16 billion out of food stamps. Right, and another $12 billion out of government, federal government and military pensions. And they raised the travel fees on airlines and so forth. They're just moving the money around. They're paying for the restoration of the cuts on the backs of the poor and the unemployed. $25 billion, right? Unemployment, That's the value of not passing the unemployment insurance extensions this year, $25 billion, $16 billion, 2 years worth of cuts in food stamps. Okay, that's $41 billion. And then, you know, we're going to cut government pensions. That's another $12 billion, and raise airline fees. Another $12 billion. So that's how they pay for it. They're just moving their money around. In fact, it's a net $20 billion in stimulus. You know, it's a little minor stimulus reduction, minor austerity move for this year. Right? Well, that was a partial deal. You know, you still have the rest of the budget for the rest of this year, the 2014 budget. And this is what they came to an agreement on here yesterday. They passed a $1.1 trillion budget deal 2.0, you might say, right? That funds the government for another 9 months through September 30th of this year. Okay. Actually, you know, it's about a little over $1 trillion. $1 trillion. You know, for social programs, all discretionary programs, you know, so on and so forth. And plus another $92 billion to continue the war. You know, we're winding down the war. Oh, yeah? Well, not in terms of dollars. You know, it's been $90 to $100 billion officially that they acknowledge for overseas contingency operations, OCOs, which is really a euphemism for Afghanistan and CIA secret drone wars everywhere, etc. Okay. And this budget, by the way, is still $164 billion less than the budget passed in 2008 under George W. Bush, discretionary budget, right? 5 years later, no, well, 6 years later, almost, the budget is still $164 billion less. Oh, but not the defense side. You know, not the war spending. Continues. And what did the Democrats give up here, you know, in this $1.1 trillion budget deal 2.0? Well, I haven't got all the details, but reportedly, they agreed to some cuts in Medicare and Medicaid to placate the Republicans and get an agreement on cutting of the Obamacare funding. You know, they're sort of chipping away at it. Operational costs and so forth to the ACA, they're chipping away. I haven't seen the details, but, you know, it's enough to satisfy the Republicans so they can go back to their constituency and say, see, we're really serious about cutting Obamacare, and, you know, we're going to chip away at this thing. Okay, we're not going to shut down the government anymore over it, because you folks don't like that. But we're going to continue this fight. We're going to make it the number one issue in the 2014 midterm elections, and it will be. Right. So Democrats, you know, agreed to smoke and mirrors and let them cut here and there. What are some other provisions of this $1.1 trillion? Oh, Obama drops his proposal for preschool funding, so education cuts here, right? They agree as well to allow the coal companies to continue dumping waste in streams and waters. You know, have you been reading what happened in West Virginia recently, right? Well, yeah, Congress says you guys can keep doing that. Dropping funding for financial regulations of the banking system through, you know, Security Exchange Commission and CFTC and other regulatory agencies. They're cutting their funding. Oh, that shows they're really serious about regulating the banks, aren't they? In fact, they just passed another liberalization of the regulations here that allows banks, financial institutions to continue some of the practices with derivatives that got us into trouble 5 years ago. So we're going back to the same situation. You know, this Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill was a joke. 2010 passed. 2010 wasn't supposed to take effect until 2014, so it gives business and bank lobbyists plenty of time to chip away and undercut it, you know, But it made the politicians look good in 2010. Oh, we're going to put some controls on these banks. Yeah. Yeah, they've been gutting it ever since. And we just got a recent gut of that so-called Volcker Rule, teeth being pulled even further with regard to derivatives. So, you know, we're back to the future on bank regulation, re-regulation. And as I've been arguing, we're on the road to more financial bubbles and another financial crisis somewhere down the road before the end of the decade. Okay. So that's the government budget deal 2.0 that was just signed. And at $1 trillion, continue the same spending on the wars, even though they say they're winding it down, and keep the Pentagon, restore all the sequester cuts for the Pentagon, who'd never been cut, by the way. They found workarounds here in the first year of the sequester this year to make sure Pentagon spending and war spending did not get cut. And now with the budget deal of last December and this one here, you know, they're going to continue restoring some social programs, yes, at the expense of the unemployed and food stamps and government workers' pensions. That's how they're going to do that, according to the December deal. And now the $1.1 trillion deal, you know, they're cutting here and there Medicaid, Medicare, education, et cetera. More of the same. Smoke and mirrors. Politicians. Definition of politician. Habitual liars. Habitual. You can't be a politician without lying and believing you're not lying. 99% of everything coming out of your mouth is lies. Small ones, big ones, whatever. Want to be a liar? Be a politician. Want to be a politician? Learn to lie. Okay. The fact that in this budget deal, there's cutting funding for regulations of the banks, and then we get this gutting, further gutting of the Volcker Rule and derivatives here at the same time, leads us to the next topic. The next topic, which is Bernanke's Bank. Bernanke's Bank. I have an article coming out in February 1st in Z Magazine, a long feature article assessing the performance of Bernanke's Bank and the Fed since 2006 through the crisis. Take a look at that. I will probably, once it appears in magazine form, I will put it up on my website, kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. You can read it then. I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And by the way, my analysis of the jobs situation is also now on my blog, jackrasmus.com, under the title of December Jobs Report, False Positives Revisited. The October blog piece was called False Positives. So if you want to see the analysis of that, go to my blog. And, of course, my analysis of the December budget deal is also there on the blog. And the bigger topic of Bernanke's Bank will be there shortly. All right, let's take a quick break and then come back. And I want to say a few things about Bernanke's Bank performance, and specifically about what I call the shadow banks, others call them that, of course, as well, and the ultra and very high net worth individuals. This is the elite core of global finance capitalists. How much money they really have? Okay, we'll talk about that shortly. One more final break, briefly, and we'll be back talking about Bernanke's Bank and ultra high net worth individuals. Okay, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is your host, and we're going to continue our discussion of recent economic developments here. And the last up on our list is Bernanke's Bank. Bernanke, as I said, Federal Reserve Chairman, will be leaving here in a couple weeks, retiring, and his Vice Chair, Janet Yellen, will be taken over. So how has Bernanke's Bank, the Fed, performed over the last 6-7 years, right? And that raises the question, how has the Fed performed? You know, the Fed this year, or last December, was 100 years old. It celebrated its 100th anniversary. So what is, what's the record of the Fed, the Federal Reserve? You know, what's it supposed to have done, and what has it done, and especially what has it done under Bernanke? Well, there are three primary functions, academic economists argue, of the Fed. What does the Fed do? What are its purposes, its functions? Well, mostly you'll hear talk about money supply management. You know, regulate the supply of money and therefore influence the economy. Money supply management. Another function is supervise the private banking system. And yet another one is to bail out the banks, to rescue them. Lender of last resort function, they call that. Right? Well, in my piece coming out in Z Magazine in a couple of weeks, you know, I argue that, of these three functions, by far, the most important of the three is bailing out the banks, first and foremost. When the banks have gotten in trouble, clearly the secondary functions of bank supervision and money supply management have been put aside by the Fed. In other words, the Fed will violate its money supply function and pump as much money as it can into the banking system to prevent them from collapsing and worry about the oversupply of money later. And then banking supervision, yes, the Fed technically is responsible for supervising the banks, and when there's a financial crash, we have a little talk about that, step up and some new forms of bank supervision. But then when the crisis passes, the supervision function is dissipated. Okay, so money supply management and bank supervision are secondary, clearly, to the primary function of the Fed, which is bailing out the banks. And in fact, in bailing out the banks, money supply is violated, and it's that same excessive injection of liquidity, money, in other words, into the system to save the banks that causes the next round of financial instability and another bank crisis. And we see this going back and forth, especially in the last several decades. The function of the Fed to rescue the banks causes further, or contributes significantly, not totally, to another financial crisis, which requires even more financial liquidity injections, and on we go in an upward spiral. Okay. In this article, by the way, I make comparisons to the origins of the Fed. You know, the Fed was created in 1913, but why? What led up to the creation of the Fed? Well, what led up to it was the banking crash of 1907-8, and a likelihood expectation of another one coming after 5 years in 1912-13. So quickly they created the Fed. What's the purpose of the Fed? So the private banks don't have to bail themselves out. And so the private banks, as in 1907-8, don't have to go to the Treasury, U.S. Treasury, and say, bail us out, which is what happened in 1907. Because when the Treasury has to bail out, then it becomes politicized. So you create a central bank, a Federal Reserve, that's able to, off the books of the federal budget and government, bail out the banks. That's the primary function. Create a separate set of books where the Fed can take on huge debt itself, and the government budget does not have to, and the taxpayer does not have to pay directly, and politicians don't have to incur the wrath of the taxpayer when they try to do this, and the Fed does that. You know, they made a mistake in 2008. The government at the time, tried to bail out the banks by getting money from Congress. They forgot the primary lesson of 1907-8 and why they created the Fed. They went to the Congress and said, give us $700 billion. That was TARP, you know, the bail out the banks didn't work. Oh, everyone politically choked on that, so they had learned that lesson. Whoop, we did it wrong. And as soon as Obama came in, the Fed was given the task of bailing out the banks. And has the Fed bailed out the banks? Yes, under Bernanke? Yes, it has. Yes, it has. What's the cost of that? Oh, somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion. Yes. And how has the Fed done that? Oh, special auctions where it loans money at no cost to these banks in trouble, fills up their bad balance sheet, and then ensures they can come back to the Fed for 5 years now and borrow at less than 1%, which the banks borrow from, and then lend to hedge funds and other wealthy, engage in stock speculation and bond speculation, whatever, and make some profits and restore their losses. And in between, if they don't know exactly what they want to spend it on for a while, they, the banks, then the Fed will say, we'll pay you interest. We'll give you free money. You leave it with us. We'll pay you interest till you decide where you can invest it and make even more than the interest we pay you. You know, that's over $10 trillion of recycled loans at no cost. Oh, and what's QE, quantitative easing? Well, what that is the Fed printing money and going out and buying up the bad subprimes and other assets on the books of banks, shadow banks, and wealthy individuals buying it up. And we don't know at what price they're buying this because the Fed won't report individual purchase deals. You know, they're probably buying these bad assets above market price. Yes, the Fed has spent somewhere between $10 and $20 trillion, depending on how you want to calculate the reflow and re-lending by the Fed, to bail out the banks. And it's done a great job. But that was the function, always, of the Fed. One time the Fed failed to do that. That was in the Great Depression. The Fed was more interested in maintaining the gold standard and didn't bail out the banks in 1930, and we had a regional banking crash, and then we had a national banking crash in 31, and another one in 32, and another one in 33, so the Fed goofed up. And that's when Roosevelt came in office and said, Fed, go sit in the closet. Go sit in the corner. We're going to let the Treasury do this from now on. And the Fed wasn't let out of the closet until the 1950s. But ever since the 1950s, whenever there is a financial problem, the Fed has pumped money in to the banks to prevent some kind of financial crisis. And it is historically true. You look at 1966, 1970, 74, early 80s, late 80s. By the 1990s, it had become globalized in Japan and so forth. The Fed keeps bailing out the banks, the Asian meltdown, dot-com boom and bust. And then the housing market, the Fed, not only just under Bernanke, but keeps pumping money into the financial system, the banks, to bail them out whenever they get overextended in terms of speculative investing. And the banks, the shadow banks, get very rich. Shadow banking assets today are $71 trillion globally, up from $60 trillion before the crash. So they've done quite well. U.S. shadow banks, $25 trillion in assets today versus $10 trillion in 2007. Commercial banks, only $14 trillion versus $10 trillion. So more and more money is shifting to the shadow banks. And who are behind the shadow banks? I'll conclude with this. They are the ultra and very high net worth individuals. This is the core elite of finance capital globally. These are folks with $30 to $100 million minimum income creation flow every year. And last year, their total assets went up $4 trillion. And this year, it's expected to go up to $4 trillion again. And this is the wealthiest 200,000 people globally. That's finance capital. And these are the folks who will really benefit from the bailouts because they are the folks with the assets in the banks and the shadow banks. Okay, that's a quick tour. Next week, we're going to review Steve Early's book, Save Our Union. We're back to that topic again. Very important book, and we'll be talking with Steve. Until next week, this is Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.